Hello, my name is Martin Dance, and this is the Tenerife Vibe. Today we have with us Pete Lauer, internationally celebrated astrophotographer, certainly on Tenerife.
Yeah, legend in my own lunchtime, so you know.
Exactly, yeah. So how long have you been on Tenerife?
We've been permanently on Tenerife since 2013, so
okay,
coming up for 11 years now. So
wow. So how have you found that, the transition from the UK to Tenerife?
Oh, absolutely love it.
Yeah, yeah.
No way would I ever go back to the UK. I don't even like going back to visit. I find it noisy, busy, dirty.
Yeah.
Everybody's stressed. We're over here. I mean, it's totally different. I mean,
Exactly. Obviously
it's nice being retired that you don't have to worry about earning a living as such.
But, exactly.
You know, no, it's a lovely island.
Yeah, it's a bit warmer, a bit just friendlier.
Just a tad. Sometimes too warm, but that's why I live in the north, because it's better than the south. It's just too hot for me.
Exactly.
I just find the people are so friendly and helpful as well.
Yeah, yeah, for
and
sure.
And my Spanish is still terrible. So.
Tell me about it. I need to work on that. So which came first, astronomy or photography?
That is a very good question. I mean, now I've got to delve back into the past, because when I first started work, and this is going to scare the life out of me, I joined a commercial photographic studio when I was 15.
Okay, wow.
And that was 1969. So
So you're familiar with like the Kodachrome film processing and all that?
I mean, we did all the processing. It's long before anything to do with computers. I mean, everything was film. Some of our cameras were sort of taking film of 250 by 200 mil sheets of film. So it's a completely different world to what it is now.
Yeah.
I mean, it was great in its own way, but it was very different. I mean, because going out on photo shoots and you're carrying not just one camera, but great big tripods, great big bellows, fixed cameras, etc. It could be just so completely different. So, I suppose you could say the photography came first, but I've always had an interest in astronomy from a little kid.
Yeah.
Albeit just on a passing basis at that age.
Yeah, sure.
But obviously, as the years went by, I built up a bigger love of astronomy, or anything scientific, basically.
Yeah.
And then obviously, when I came out here, although I delved into some astrophotography in the past, being film based, it's far more difficult and not nearly so successful.
Mm.
But once I retired out here, it gave me the opportunity to really develop. Pardon the pun, my skills, and to take it to a much higher level.
So how did you combine the two hobbies?
Well, I think that's a process that you don't really realise it's happening.
Right.
As I say, I'd done some astrophotography with film, as I say, which is actually quite difficult and not very successful. I've always had telescopes, so I've always looked at the skies, if you like. And when I came over to permanently into Tenerife, I bought myself another big telescope.
Right.
And I really enjoyed looking through that. But it comes to a point where you know that your eyes just aren't sensitive enough.
Right.
So what you can see through a telescope, I mean, a lot of people, actually, if they've never looked through a telescope before, find it quite disappointing.
It's just a snapshot, isn't it? Like a photograph.
And also, you know, unless you're looking at something like the moon, which is spectacular for a telescope, or one of the planets like Jupiter or Saturn, then all the nebulae, etc., all they look is like a faint smudge, even with the biggest amateur telescopes. Yeah. You can't really get any detail or any colour out of them. So that's when I realised that, yes, you can take it a lot further now with digital cameras, etc.
Right.
And it gradually built from there, and my expertise grown, and now, as I say, it's to a level where, well, I know a lot of it, but you never learn all of it, because as soon as you learn something, somebody else brings out something new, or there's a different technique. So
it's an evolutionary sort of.
It's always evolutionary, and you're always learning.
Yeah, yeah. So, do you believe in aliens?
I believe there is life out there, I don't believe any aliens have ever visited Earth. I think the odds of that are so infinitesimally small.
Yeah.
But when you consider our galaxy has somewhere between 100 and 200 billion stars.
Mm-hmm. That's just our galaxy.
Just our galaxy. It's the Milky Way.
That's quite
a lot. And the majority of those have planets. Not all of them will support life. Mm. And then you consider that the universe that we know of has 2 trillion galaxies.
Mm.
You multiply 2 trillion by 1 or 200 billion, then the odds of there not being life, I think, are infinitesimally small.
Mm.
Whether they're the same level, advanced level, or whatever to us, or whether it's intelligent life, then that is another matter. But I think there must be life out there. Mm. But as I say, the odds of them being coming to see us, I think, are small. One, they'd have to get over the technology that we can't even understand at the moment.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah.
And two, if they got that technology, we would be a very backward civilization. So why would they really bother?
Exactly, yeah.
So,
I mean, there's a lot of conspiracy theorists about that massive comet that passed by that kind of changed direction, and people thought that that might have been a like an alien spaceship, but I can't see it myself.
Well, there's a lot of flat earthers around as well. So.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean,
the Earth's not flat.
No, I'm sorry. It's, you know, I hate to disappoint you. Yeah, I mean, there's conspiracy theories about everything nowadays.
Exactly.
I mean, this is one of the downsides of social media, if you like. It's given...
Everyone's got a platform.
Yeah.
I mean, look at me.
Precisely. Well, I can't say any more about that, really. No, it's... there are several things that you can't explain, but the vast majority of it can be quite easily explained.
There's a logical pattern, or you can work through it.
Yes, I mean, exactly, you know, the science, even if it can't prove definitively exactly what it was, is far more likely than the alternative of, it's aliens.
Yeah, I'll refrain. So I know recently there was a partial eclipse here in Tenerife.
Mm.
Are there any up-and-coming cosmic events happening that you can see with the naked eye?
Not to any great extent. I mean, the next really big one, it won't be in Tenerife as such, but there is a total solar eclipse that goes through Spain in 2026.
Oh, okay, where?
We'd be the closest we get until, I think, the next one in Tenerife is in about 2240.
So
I don't think I'll be around for that one. Mm. But the one in Spain that...
You're going to travel for that
one? Try to get over there sort of thing. I mean, a friend of mine's got a motorhome, so who also runs one of the astronomy groups. So I'm hoping to persuade him that we can all go diving over in that.
Exactly, yeah, that sounds great.
Yeah. I mean, there's always something going on in the sky. I mean, we've just had the comet Pons-Brooks coming through the sky.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw the picture I took and managed to get of that.
I don't think I saw that one.
No. But yes, I mean, that became fairly bright, which makes a change, because most of the time the newspapers come up with, oh, we're going to see this great comet in the sky, and it never really happens. But that one, although it didn't get to naked eye brightness, it got pretty bright that you could see it with binoculars, etc.
Okay, so, that sounds nice.
Yeah, and there's supposed to be a really good one coming towards the end of the year as well. So, as I say, there's always something to look at. And The beauty of it now is we've got the Milky Way rising in the early hours of the morning.
Okay.
Which
is that close to dawn or?
I mean, it rises about 3 o'clock in the morning at the moment.
Okay.
Which is why I get very tired sometimes, because I've been taking people up at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. So I'm having to get up at 1 or 2 to go up there.
Yeah.
But most people have never really seen the Milky Way.
No.
When you go up into the Caldera in Tidal National Park, the skies are so dark.
Yeah,
that is quite amazing. It just, I mean, you can see why it was called the Milky Way, because it just, when you first look at it, it just looks like a silvery white bank cloud running across the sky.
Okay. Like a milky, like a milky flow.
That's it. That's exactly what it looks like. Okay. I mean, once again, you need astrophotography to bring out the colours in it, because there are lots of spectacular colours. But as I say, that's another reason why I got into it. So you can see the real beauty of the night sky.
Yeah. Okay. So, as of March 2024, there are 5,504 Starlink satellites that Elon Musk launched. Does that affect your photography?
Yes. It does and it doesn't to a certain extent. I mean, when he first launches them, they come across in a train.
Oh, okay, yeah,
and
yeah.
And they are really bright and intrusive.
Before they sort of settle into
Yes, then they spread out. Okay. But when you think the size of them, once they've settled down into their orbits, they are infinitesimally tiny.
Of course, yeah.
And although, obviously, they reflect the sun, Elon Musk has started to put a coating on them to stop them being so bright. And one of the advantages we have nowadays with modern technology is when I'm shooting, say, a nebula, and I might be taking loads and loads of shots, which I'll stack later, the technology has the ability to look at when the satellite goes across and take it out of the picture. So you can lose an awful lot of it.
Right, right.
That's the beauty of computer technology nowadays, is you can...
Fine-tune it in the edit.
Yes. So, but yeah, it's still a nuisance, because sometimes you go across and all you see is orbits of, you know, of satellites going across all the time.
Yeah, yeah. I did see a train of satellites in a, was it a sunrise photograph? Because the sun bounces off them.
So yes, I mean, it depends exactly where the sun is. But yes, it's quite spectacular to actually see it.
Yeah.
And I mean, when the first one came across here, I mean, I had a few emails from messages from people saying, what was that going across there? So I've never seen a whole train of lights going across.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
so, it's, you know, it is spectacular to see, but frustrating at times when you're trying to get some shots.
If that's not what you want, then it's kind of an obstacle, right? I guess. So when do you think Betelgeuse will explode, and will it affect us?
Right. Anywhere from any second now to about 100,000 years.
Oh, wow.
Which is, in astronomical terms, instant.
Right.
If you like, because, I mean, in astronomical timescales, 100,000 years is nothing.
It's a blink, right?
So they really don't know. It will only affect us in the fact that when it does go up, it'll probably be visible in daylight. It'll be so bright for a couple of months.
Wow.
But the radiation, et cetera, and that is too far away to actually do us any harm or any damage. But it will be a spectacular view.
Yeah, yeah.
But once again, whether I'll be around or not...
Will anyone?
Yeah. I mean, to be perfectly honest, it could have already exploded.
That's true.
And we won't know for, I can't remember how far.
It's quite far, isn't it?
Away,
but it's massive, isn't it?
So. Yeah. But it's, you know, it's a few hundred light years at least. It's at least a few hundred years.
Yeah, yeah.
In the past, we're actually seeing it. So, as I say, once again, this is what makes your mind boggle, is when we look at the sky, we're actually looking into the past. And things that have already happened haven't actually... The light hasn't reached us yet.
It's an interesting question. So if you're already a photographer, what kit might you need to take reasonable photos, and what software?
Oh, now that is a very big question. Are you talking purely astrophotography now?
Just purely astrophotography.
Right. Best way to start off is just with a tripod and a simple DSLR.
Yeah. Full frame?
Full frames, crop frame,
anything.
3x4, doesn't matter. You can do it. I've had too many people come with all the gear and not have the foggiest idea what they're doing.
Right.
And it's like any hobby. You need to be able to walk before you can run. And
start with things that are a bit closer.
Yeah, I mean, what we're looking at mainly is to start with doing things like nightscapes. So you're taking pictures of the Milky Way over a landscape, if you like, which gives you a very pleasing thing. Also, when you want to progress onto the next thing, the most important bit of gear you can buy is a tracking mount.
Right.
Because obviously, when you look at the sky, I would say the stars don't move. It's actually the Earth rotating, which gives the illusion the stars moving. So if you take a long exposure of more than, say, 20 or 30 seconds, the stars are going to trail.
That's right,
So you have to have a mount
that
will follow the stars and keep them in alignment all the time.
So you track from the North Star?
Yes.
And then rotate everything around that.
Yeah, what we have to do is set up the tracking mount to align with the axis of the Earth.
Right, right.
And the way we do that is we look at the latitude we're at, which here is 28 degrees.
Yeah.
So you set an angle on the mount of 28 degrees and then point it due north effectively.
Yeah.
And then that way it will track the stars very accurately.
Wow. That sounds good. And then presumably they need a bit of software to stack it.
Yes.
To stack the images.
Yeah, I mean, one of the beauties of astrophotography and astronomy is there's a lot of highly competent computer nerds out there who produce some very, very good software and then give it away.
Wow.
I mean, things like stacking software. Sequator is one of the ones I use an awful lot. It's totally free. There's a new fairly new bit of software that does not only the stacking but all the process as well, called Cyril, which is S-I-R-I-L,
yeah,
which is a very comprehensive program.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, completely free. So as I say, that's why I like it, because so many other hobbies you come across, they charge you a fortune for
exactly,
bits
yeah.
of processes.
Yeah, yeah. So if someone listening wanted to get involved, could you recommend a beginner telescope? How long's a piece of string, right?
Precisely. It depends exactly what you want to do.
Yeah.
And that's why I say you start off with just a camera and a lens and then possibly go on to a tracking mount, because then you can use a longer lens on your camera.
Mm-hmm.
And some of these objects are surprisingly large. I mean, if you look at the Andromeda Galaxy, which if you look through a binocular telescope, just looks like a faint blob. Its actual size in the sky visually is 6 times larger than the full moon.
Okay, wow, didn't it?
But because it's so faint,
right,
you don't see it. But, you know, with a 135, 200 mil lens on an ordinary DSLR and a tracking scope, you can get some really good shots of it. You don't need a telescope. I mean, then after that, then one of the scopes I use an awful lot, especially when I'm teaching, is a Skywatcher 72ED, because it's light, portable. It's got an equivalent focal length of about 420 mil. So it can take an awful lot of the nebula in the sky. I say most of these things are quite large.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So they don't need massive blow-ups, if you like.
Is that the one you showed us when we went to see Saturn?
No.
Oh, is that a different one?
That's a different one.
Oh, okay, sure.
Because Saturn and Jupiter and the other planets are very, very small.
Yeah, yeah.
We need a much longer focal length
telescope.
I mean, that particular telescope's got equivalent of 1,800 millimetre focal length.
Wow.
And even that doesn't bring it up very large.
But I was actually impressed that I could see
the first Saturn. Time anybody sees the rings around Saturn
is
quite spectacular.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is why you can't say, well, that telescope will do anything. I mean, there are some telescopes that will do an awful lot, but you are going to pay an awful lot of money for them.
I guess it's budget and commitment. It's,
I mean, a good budget, a good lightweight tracking mount like the Skywatcher GTI, which is very, very portable, very light, and it will take up to about the Skywatcher 72ED, is about €650. And the telescope is about another 350. So you're about €1,000 to start off with, if you want to progress past just a DLSR.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I did borrow a Celestron 4SE.
Yeah, I saw the picture of that.
That was a little while ago, a couple of months ago. And I managed to track it, get it to point to Jupiter.
Yeah.
And at that particular time, I saw four of its moons.
That's right, yeah.
And it was in like a reverse Z shape.
Yeah, because, I mean, they're basically circling, not quite on the same level, but very close.
Just slightly offset.
Yeah. So you've got...
But the fact that I even saw Jupiter floating in space.
Yeah, bit of gas floating in space.
Okay, whatever.
No rocket Jupiter.
Isn't there? Okay, but, fine. Fair enough. Are there any astronomy experiences you can recommend on Tenerife?
One of the best things to do initially is just go with one of the tours to do stargazing. Got to be a little bit careful. There's some good and some bad ones. Mm. I mean, some of them, they've got coach loads, so you don't get an awful lot of attention. Some of the smaller ones, I mean, one of my friends actually runs, which is Dark Skies Tenerife Guide.
Yeah. Google it.
Yeah. It is very good because they limit the size of the groups.
Gotcha.
And, I mean, they pick you up from the hotel, take you home, give you a good demonstration of the telescopes you can see and not see.
And it's limited numbers, so...
Yes, I mean, they use mini buses, so they don't have hundreds of people, because you see, you go up sometimes and you see coach loads coming off, and, I mean, you've got 30, 40, 50 people. It's very difficult to give a decent thing, but...
You lose that personal touch.
Precisely. So when you keep it down to perhaps no more than 12, 15, you can control it more.
Yeah.
It means you've got more... The people have got more time on the telescopes, because, I mean...
Because you rotate round to...
Yeah, because Steve, the guy who runs it with a couple of his guides, I mean, they've got all between them about 5 different scopes of different sizes, depending on what they're doing.
Yeah.
So there's always something... to really look at.
Yeah.
And they're very, very knowledgeable about the sky. Far more knowledgeable than I am now, because right. I've forgotten half of what I've learned. So.
Well, there's a lot of information to keep up to date with.
Yeah, oh yes. That's my excuse, and I'm sticking to it. Nothing to do with my age.
Well, I think the James Webb Telescope has a lot to say for itself.
Yes. That's what that is producing is phenomenal.
Yeah.
It will only get better. I mean, it's in its early days yet. And, I mean, it's what comes after James Webb.
That sounds even more exciting.
Yeah, I mean, I think it will really take off is when we go back to the moon and get permanent bases.
Yeah, yeah.
Because if they can put a large telescope on the far side of the moon so that you don't get the glare of the Earth, they will be able to do phenomenal things. But I don't think I'll be around for that, so...
I'm not sure how far away that is, but I think Elon Musk's trying to get to Mars.
Yeah, I mean, I think realistically, you're talking 30 to 50 years.
Yeah, yeah. Before we get permanent base there.
Yeah, so, I mean, hopefully within the next year or two, we'll get people back onto the moon.
Yeah.
I think it'll probably be 5 to 10 years before there's a permanent base on the moon.
Yeah.
And by that time, I'll be sort of approaching 80, so...
It's ambitious.
It is, yeah.
You've got to get a lot of stuff there to sustain life.
Yeah, this is why they're looking for water on the moon, because they can sustain an awful lot of things with water. They can make rocket fuel, obviously, water to live on, etc.
Gotcha.
And, you know, plants.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an exciting time. And I think one of the advantages, and love him or hate him with Elon Musk, he's brought speed to the space industry, where NASA have produced some great stuff, but it takes them years and years and hundreds of committees and
loads of paperwork, I expect.
Loads of paperwork and budgeting, etc., etc.
He's just done it.
Yeah, he just goes ahead and does it.
Yeah.
I mean, and we're seeing more and more private industry coming into this, and NASA has realised it's actually cheaper to outsource it to a lot of these companies.
Exactly.
That's, I think, has advanced it tremendously, and I think that will accelerate as well, because as people see the benefit... I mean, one of the things, of course, is they're looking at now is there's several companies that are looking to mine space. By
to what?
To mine it.
Mines, like the comets and stuff that go past?
Well, through asteroids. I mean,
yeah.
There's one particular asteroid. I mean, not particularly big. It's about 30 kilometres across. They reckon the value is several trillion dollars.
Is that close or?
No.
Is it in our rotation somewhere?
It's somewhere in the orbit. So, they're varying because, I mean, the majority of asteroids are in the asteroid belt, which is between Mars and Jupiter. But there are asteroids that come close to Earth, etc.
Yeah.
And they're looking at being able to capture them, bring them in and mine them.
Oh, wow.
Once again, that's not short term. That's going to be long term. But there's companies actively doing it. And they're actively about to send up rockets to do some tests. Once again, I'm thinking you're talking 20 to 50 years before they actually do it.
Yeah.
But it will bring space so much closer, if you like, because if they can mine the asteroids, they can also manufacture up in space, which means you haven't got to lift everything up from Earth.
Yeah. Presumably the resources from those comets will go to a base on the moon somewhere.
Yeah, or it might be a massive space station by then and a manufacturing process.
Exactly, yeah.
So there are so many different possibilities.
Yeah.
But as I say, that is quite some way away, yeah.
That's quite interesting, yeah. Wow. I feel like I've barely scratched the surface of the moon with you on this subject. It seems like quite a big subject, and it's changing all the time.
Absolutely. I mean, the trouble is, the moon, anything to do with the universe, space, what theories we have now are subject to change all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the basis of things like Newton, Einstein, etc., have been fairly robust, but they are being adapted when we find new ways of looking at them. Scientists like Stephen Hawking, etc., developing them further. And that's only going to produce, because, I mean, in reality, we probably know about 5% of what out there.
Yeah.
So there's still plenty to learn, plenty to discover.
Yeah.
And things like dark matter, dark energy, which we still have no understanding of, contribute about 95% of the total of the universe.
Okay, wow.
So we only know about 5% of matter.
That's nothing really, is it?
No. So as I say, we've got a long way to go.
Yeah.
And it's a very exciting time, quite a mind-boggling time, because when you start looking into it, it's, especially if you look into the maths, forget it.
yeah, very big numbers.
Yeah, very, very big numbers.
Yeah. So do you have any astrophotographers that you enjoy, aspire to be more like, or inspire you personally?
Oh, yes, there's... There's several. I mean, there are some very, very good Asterisk photographers. Unfortunately, we just recently lost one in Alan Wallace. I mean, he was a great astrophotographer, but unfortunately he died a couple of weeks ago. He's only
34.
Yeah, he got an infection in his gallbladder and
things.
So it's just another reason why you've got to enjoy life as you where you can.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, other people like Stefan Lieberman is brilliant. He often comes over to Tenerife. So yeah, I mean, there's lots out there that may make my efforts look very, very mediocre, if you like.
It's a team effort, I think. Every contribution helps.
It does, but also they have a lot more money.
I recently went up to the observatory with a friend of ours, and I was actually blown away because you say, oh, observatory, that's like one or two telescopes. I think it's about 35 telescopes, all owned by different countries.
Oh, right, yeah.
And there's a few Open University telescopes that you, if you're on the courses, you can use them.
Absolutely. They're used remotely sort of things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Those two telescopes that are permanently pointing towards the sun. You can see the solar flare and then you can see the dark spots on the sun as well.
Yeah, the sunspots.
And it just blew me away. But
well, have a look at my website because I've got a solar scope now at home so I can pick up the flares and the spots. Very, very interesting to watch. But one thing I will say is don't look at it without special equipment because the sun will blind you instantly if you try to look through a telescope or binoculars without the suitable filters, etc.
Yeah, a bit like looking into a laser beam, I expect.
Oh, far, far worse. I mean, the filters I use block out 99.9% of the light from the sun, and that's what you need. I mean, sunglasses, etc., don't even touch the surface of it. So you've got to be very, very careful with that.
Yeah, I just found it funny that when he was talking about the cold spots on the sun, they're still like 3,000 degrees centigrade.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they only look dark because the surround of it is even hotter and brighter.
Exactly.
They're not actually dark at all. But no, it's, once again, it's quite amazing when you look at it to see how active our sun is. And at the moment, it's in one of its active periods.
Oh, is it? Oh, I didn't know.
Yeah, because it goes through an 11-year cycle of being quite calm and hardly any spots and hardly anything going on to coming up to what we call a really active cycle when you're getting lots of spots. Once again, they really don't understand fully why it goes through this 11-year cycle.
Okay, sure. Does that include like more solar flares than normal?
Yes.
And do you know how big those are in terms of?
Oh, some of those solar flares can be sort of, you know, millions of miles high. Yeah.
They flare out and then go back again?
They flare out and some of them release.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So your prominence goes back, a flare breaks away and comes off. Wow. And this is where we get the problems when the solar flare heads our way.
Right.
Because the solar wind and the particles it carries, I mean, in the past, about 20 or 30 years ago now, it wiped out all the power stations in Canada.
Oh, wow.
And it's capable of destroying satellites, etc. I mean, we're very lucky that we have a magnetic field that protects us from the worst of it. But as I say, it can be extremely damaging, and with spacecraft, etc., the astronauts have safe places to go to protect themselves if they do get a massive solar flare heading towards them.
Wow.
It's not easy or straightforward all the time.
No. Well, I guess we're looking at something that we don't fully understand.
Yeah.
And we can't possibly begin to understand it because we can't monitor it.
No.
Not fully.
No. I mean, we obviously, with the sun, they have several satellites going around it. I mean, some of them are extremely close.
Okay, wow.
I mean, they've got one, I've forgotten what it's called now, but it has a major shield in front of it to protect it because it's virtually into the atmosphere of the sun.
Wow.
And it effectively has instruments that can just poke out the side, take pictures and, precisely. It's amazing what the technology that they can produce nowadays to get these things. But, you know, man's a very inventive person.
Yeah,
very destructive as well. But
Yeah, don't want to get into that.
No.
Okay, well, I think that's all we've got time for in this session. I think we can dig a bit deeper if you wanted to go for another one at some point in the future.
Yeah, I mean, I'm quite happy to come along and do some of that. Okay. And as I say, you know, anybody wants to have a look on Facebook, I mean, my site that I run is Tenerife Astronomy and Astrophotography.
Okay.
Which, I say, a lot of my pictures and a lot of other pictures from other people as well. So always worth a look. Yeah. Well, that's what I say anyway.
Yeah. And not forgetting the Dark Skies Tenerife.
Yeah, darkskiestenerifeguide.com.
Okay.
They do produce very, very good guides and tours.
Yeah. Okay, great. I think we've had some great tips and some great information there, Pete. Thanks a lot. Appreciate you coming on the show.
That's no problem at all.
Thanks a lot.
Nice to be here. Thank you.